Today at Reader's Corner, Alan Heathcock, author of the short story collection Volt and the winner of the 2012 National Whiting Writers Award.
What storytelling is creating a capacity for someone to read a story and become someone who is not them. What do I think is important? What do I find interesting? What do I want to say? And I always kind of begin there. For whatever reason, I'm very interested in people and their stories. And that's, of course, why I chose this as a profession. It seems to be a necessity for me. I just kind of feel like I've won some very lucky life out of this whole writing thing.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Volt, the title of Alan Heathcock's acclaimed collection of linked short stories, is as electric as the name implies. Set in the fictional town of Crafton, a lonely and windswept hamlet, the eight stories in Volt feature an unforgettable cast of characters who confront floods, violence, family strife, longing, and loss. Since its release last year by Grey Wolf Press, Volt has garnered a raft of critical acclaim and attention. It was named a New York Times Editor's Choice and was a Best Book 2011 from numerous newspapers and magazines. In October, Alan Heathcock was honored with the National Whiting Writers Award. The prestigious $50,000 awards are given each year to 10 outstanding writers, including poets, playwrights, fiction and nonfiction writers, and are based on both accomplishment and promise. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Alan Heathcock. He is a faculty member in Boise State's MFA program in creative writing and a 2004 graduate of the MFA program. Al is also the 2012 National Endowment for the Art Literature Fellow. He joined us in the studio for this interview. Al Heathcock, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
It's just great to see the success that your book has had. Every time I open up a critical review, I've been on your website, by the way, and I would encourage people to go on to your website to get a really good look at just what this book has achieved. It's just been remarkable. And it is a short story collection. What does this say about, I won't call it the revival, because I'm sure you guys who are into short story collections don't think there's anything wrong
right.
with short story right. collections, and I don't either, but let's face it, there are a lot of folks who think that, I'll go pick up a novel, but,
right.
I don't want to get into this short story business. Are you going to help with a resurgence of interest here?
Well, I hope so. I mean, short stories have always meant a great deal to me. Some of my greatest reading experiences, some of the reasons I am a writer are because of short stories that I read. You know, going back to being a teenager and reading some of Hemingway's short stories, the story Indian Camp was probably my first very vivid, potent reading experience. And so I think short stories have such an important place in my life. I would hope that we can get over the public relations problems that short stories have out in the world, both with publishers and with the public, and people can find their way into understanding the great value that short stories have. It's great literature. I'm happy for multiple reasons that the book has done well, but one of them is that it has shown that a story collection is viable not only as an art piece but as a saleable commodity. And so that makes me happy because it might open the doors for some other story collections.
Now, this story collection, and it's not like it's the only one that has ever done this, but this story collection is somewhat unique in that the reader will find characters throughout the book. They recur in your short stories, and that doesn't always happen. I have to say that in my reading of short story collections over the years, I oftentimes did not find that to be the case.
Right, sure.
Mitch Wieland actually did it to the
right.
point where it was a novel in short stories.
That's right.
But you chose to bring these characters back. People like Helen Faraday come back more than once in these short stories. Do you think that if you're the reader of a collection of short stories, or you go pick up Volt and you're looking at the cover and you're reading the reviews and you're saying, wow, look at this. This characters are coming back. I wonder if that doesn't help sell the book when it comes to what people are looking for, in that there's a
yeah.
familiarity beyond just one story.
That's right. You know, I've tried to get my head around, as a reader, what I look for, and that familiarity does pay itself off. going around the country the past year and talking with people who've read the book time and time again, that people would say, you know, I get excited when Helen would show up again, or I would get excited when Vernon Hamby, the pastor, would show up again or something. So I understand that you build a familiarity. You get a kinship built with these characters over time. And that's just one strategy of writing stories. I mean, it's not a new strategy. You know, this book by Sherwood Anderson, Winesburg, Ohio, which is right. One of my biggest influences, certainly did it in his book to great effect. And it had a powerful impact on the way I understood story and writing and affected my worldview and everything else. Mm-hmm. But it has to do with using these characters again and again. And for why I did it, I just found it useful. You have a character in Helen Fairley, who's the town sheriff, who represents kind of justice, and Pastor Hamby, Vernon Hamby, who kind of was, the morality questioner in the book. And I just found that having them in the stories made sense because I was using them in particular ways. For a reader, it just breeds familiarity. They mm-hmm. become to grow connected with the characters and understand who they are. So when they would come on screen again, you wouldn't have to explain who they are. We can already hit right. the ground running with right. that familiarity.
Many of the great American novelists, if you go back to where they started, started with a collection of short stories or maybe even more than one collection and then decided to sit down and write the great American novel. I understand you're sitting down to write the great American novel. I'll call it that. You don't have to call it that.
Let's hope that's the idea.
That's right.
That's the idea, of course. But yeah, you know, it's even when I was writing the stories, I was always working on novels too off on the side. In fact, really a lot of what Volt is two failed novels
right.
that have fractured into stories. People would comment on the stories saying, you know, how do you get the character so deep? It's like you've written hundreds of pages about him. I'm like, well, I have. That one short story was a part of a novel that just didn't work out. But I am working on a novel now, and I'm very excited about it. And I'm getting deeper and deeper into it. And I'm fairly certain, knock on wood, that this one won't collapse on me. I've learned my lessons from the past. But novel writing is a great logistical challenge in just finding a story that is expansive enough to fill the amount of pages with the same characters in the same
sure.
narrative arc and keeping everything straight. Mm-hmm. But I'm just having a blast with that challenge. I just finally had to. I work in a trailer in the side driveway outside of my house, and I needed like a blackboard, like a whiteboard, to keep notes on, just characters'
keep
names.
Keep track of everybody, right?
And names of places and things like that. And my trailer is not big enough to have this big whiteboard that I bought. So finally, just a few weeks ago, I usually, you know, it's summertime now, I open the trailer door and I can see the side of the house. So I just finally went over and installed a great big whiteboard on the side of my house, which my neighbors kind of laugh at, but it helps me keep track of things. But that's the challenge now, is just the great logistical challenge of trying to keep track of this expansive story.
You're listening to Alan Heathcock, author of the short story collection, Volt. Jim Harrison wrote a short story called Legends of the Fall, and Annie Prue did Brokeback Mountain. These are movies that all came from this small short story. So let's talk about another facet of a writer's career, and that is when the day comes that Hollywood comes calling or some film industry comes calling and wants to move your short stories into the film realm. Tell us about what's going on with Volt in that respect.
Well, I'm very excited about this. I'm probably as big a film fan as I am a bibliophile. And, I watch well over 200 movies a year. And I've always been hoping that I can get a toe into that world as well. And so we have right now a short film version of the story. Fort Apache is being filmed in upstate New York by a very, very talented young director named Madison Meir. And I've just been getting little glimpses of what they're doing, and I'm completely blown away. I'm very excited, but they have the sky is the limit for what their goals are for that film, so I can't wait to see the finished product, and probably later in the summer we'll be able to get the first glimpse of what that is. And so I've helped him with the script on that, and I've just a few weeks ago begun working with a film agent, and have begun figuring out how to write screenplays, and I'm working on a screenplay now for the story The Daughter, which is a longer story in the collection, which we both thought was already about the length of a feature film in terms of how expansive the story is and how it would fit. And so I was laughing because I was talking with the agent. She's, you know, we had a very long conversation about what we would see as the strategy of entering this world. And she said, so do you have any questions for me? And I said, yeah, how do you write a screenplay? And she laughed. And I wasn't exactly joking. I've seen so many movies. I know what a story is, and I know what a movie screenplay would be in terms of the storytelling. But I've had to learn, you know, the different formatting and all of that stuff. But it clicked with me quicker than I thought it would, and I've been off to the races, so I'm doing The Daughter right now. I'm just about done with that, and then I'm going to jump immediately off and start doing a screenplay that will be maybe a version of the story Peacekeeper, but it'll be a Helen Farrelly sheriff story. So it'll be a different version of that story that will be large enough for a feature film. But, man, I'm having so much fun. I kind of have the best job on earth anyway, but I'm so excited to wake up every morning and getting to go out and just write some screenplays and then a couple hours working on the novel. I just kind of feel like I have won some very lucky life out of this whole writing thing.
Is it tough sitting down early in the morning and starting? I know once you get into it, that probably eases up. But do you have those moments where it's like, oh, man, I think I have a writer's block. What am I going to do this morning?
Well, I think the first thing I always do, I try not to get into a fight with it. And that's kind of what I tell my students. I think sometimes we just kind of get into a fight with it. If on any given day I'm not sure what I want to write, which I think some people call writer's block, and they get freaked out about it, I just sit there and I think about, what do I want to write? I just try not to expend any energy on thinking that I can't do something. I just figure out how to do the next thing. So usually the very first, I'm a morning person anyway, which helps, but the very first thing I do when I go out, I kind of sit down and I make a plan for my day, which is, you know, what am I going to try to accomplish today? And usually give myself something very reasonable and manageable to accomplish, and just come at it every day that way. I think if you do it enough, after a while, you learn that you don't try to hold the whole thing in your head. It's too much. I think that's when people start to freak out. Like, I have to figure out the entire novel today. And they get very anxious about the whole thing. And once you've been doing it for a while, you can kind of settle into knowing that you just need to do today's work. And let me take care of what I need to do today and attack it as vigorously as I can intellectually and get my imagination where it needs to go. And if I can do that, then I'm satisfied with my day's work. And the days accumulate. The journey begins with a step, that whole staying. So that's all I do. I don't ever feel like I have writer's block, because sometimes you need to think about some things. So I don't call it that.
I guess this next question comes under the category of, where do you get your material? I mean, you have really incredible insights into human behavior in this novel, and it just raises the question, is this something that just all comes out of previous life experiences growing up in Hazel Crest, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago? Or do you just have to take a pause every now and then as a writer and go out and live life with those who you want to write about and sit in the old cafe and talk to the old geezer that has a take on life that you're not going to get at Boise State University's campus hanging out with undergraduates?
Yeah.
What's this? How do you do that yourself?
Well, it's all of the above. It's, I always say that I'm never not a writer now. I'm always a writer. So, you know, even sitting here on campus at Boise State University, some of the most compelling things that I've been putting into the book I'm working out now come from that. And I've had students who've have been soldiers and have been coming back from war in Iraq, and I have found their stories to be immensely compelling and have brought me new insights on the human story to what it means to be at war. In terms of Volt, the book, a lot of it was family stories and me trying to make sense of things that I saw and that I was in close proximity to as a younger man, and trying to make sense of, you know, the grief and anger that I had as a younger man, and trying to look at those things. But, I'm never not a writer, and I seek out stories, too. So one of my favorite things to do is I love sitting around the diner, like as you said, and hearing the geezers tell stories.
Right.
That's always been one of my – I used to love going ice fishing up in Minnesota, because when you go ice fishing, you don't really fish. You just sit around with old guys and they tell you stories. And there's nothing greater. I think I'm very interested in the way people live and why they live the way they do, and the impact that the things that happen to our lives – have on the individual and on the family and on the community. For whatever reason, again, just the way I'm wired, I've been immensely interested in these things, and so I seek out stories. I was just down in Brazil on a little reading tour down there, and even down there, I could not speak very much Portuguese, but I found myself fumbling around trying to, because I met one gentleman who was the Brazilian equivalent of a cowboy. And he said something, the translator was telling me something about his life, some hardship that he had. And I immediately, you know, the lights went on. And I said, well, you know, tell me a little bit about that. You know, what happened with that? And, you know, we talked for 20 minutes about this one thing. And so I always kind of, for whatever reason, I'm very interested in people and their stories. And that's, of course, why I chose this as a profession. It seems to be a necessity for me.
You're listening to Alan Heathcock. He is the author of Volt. He teaches creative writing at Boise State University, which is a great opportunity for us to pass his work on to our students. And let's talk about that for a moment, teaching creative writing. You've been given a great gift. I mean, I know you work hard. I know you've applied yourself. You have gone out and sought these experiences. But when you cut through it all, there's a great gift that is given certain people in the writing profession, and you're at the top of the forum right now. I guess the question I ask everybody who comes on this show who writes is, can you pass that on? To what extent can you teach creative writing and make little Alan Heathcocks out of these students that we have here at Boise State?
Well, I hope not to make them little Alan Heathcocks, but I understand the question. I think there's a great deal that can be taught. I mean, I think I try to approach it in a way where I'm not promising anybody that they will have great success in publishing. I try to remove that from the equation. I mean, I greatly admire our football coach, Chris Peterson. I get in trouble from my very literary friends for bringing football into the conversation about art. But the truth is, you know, I kind of have heard from, I've had different, a couple of his players over the years in my classrooms too, and I really admire the way he teaches, because it is focusing on the skill, focusing on the skill set, focusing on how the skills that you develop as an individual apply themselves to something bigger. And it's the same way. I'm trying to, as a teacher, get to know each student as an individual, which makes a little bit more work for me, but it makes it immediately more effective. What I think creative writing is that for some reason in some people, I think in all people, but in some people take classes for it, there is something in them that they need to say, some story in them, some feeling in them that needs to be expressed. Sometimes when they come to my classroom, they don't quite understand, other than maybe they've read something or seen a movie and they have this strong desire to try to do it themselves. And so it's my job to get back to a base level of, you know, what do you want to say? What do you find interesting? Which I think is an exceptionally valuable question, and one that doesn't get asked enough in our education system. My wife's a fifth grade teacher, so we have conversations all the time about teaching to the test. And so the two things that creative writing does is one, it makes a person look at themselves and ask, what do I think is important? What do I find interesting? What do I want to say? And I always kind of begin there. If we can get the student back to that place, then they become passionate, you know. I have something to say. And if you can get them impassioned about it, then you can teach them the craft of building empathy through words, which is what storytelling is creating a capacity for someone to read a story and become someone who is not them, one of the characters, to have live a life vicariously through the stories. And that's another skill set that I think is in great demand, is developing the skill set of empathy, of being able to have empathetic capacities. We now live in a world where we're so divided in so many ways, and it's kind of this me in so many ways that I really, really push that, because that's the skill set you need, but it's also a skill set of value for those who don't go on to publish. So if we get them back to, what do you want to say? And here is the skill sets of understanding people who are not you and how to express those things into words. And then beyond that, we teach them how to write a good sentence, what makes a good verb, how to select the right image, how to frame dialogue, you know, those sorts of hard things. Now, not everybody is going to have the stuff to whatever, have the great American novel or whatever. I don't think that matters. I think that writing has great value in people's lives. And so I just try to keep it there. And if people see, if I get the students to see the value of that in their lives, then they'll write for the rest of their lives just because they want it in their lives. And who knows what happens on the publishing side.
Well, in the under the category of true confessions, Alan, I have to tell you that I tried to write a novel once. And the story part of it, it was going to be a murder mystery set in northern Wisconsin, because doing a lot of fishing up in Wisconsin at that time. And so I didn't have any problem with the narrative, with the story. I really never got far enough to know whether I would have a problem with the plot. But I was writing this narrative about this guy who was going to have to solve this crime. But the dialogue, and you mentioned framing dialogue, freaked me out. In fact, that killed the project right there.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't figure out how to get inside the character and speak for them.
Yeah.
I just felt I was so much Bob Custer, I guess,
yeah,
that I couldn't get to be Helen Farley, for example.
Yeah.
Fairly. I couldn't make that happen. Do you teach? You teach that? Can you learn those things?
Well, that's a tough skill set. I mean, I think some of my students who have journalistic trainings struggle with writing fiction, because I think fiction has more of a kinship to, say, acting than it does to journalism.
Right.
In that a part of your job is to lose Alan Heathcock completely. And I work very, very hard every day. I mean, that's a good portion of every day is losing Alan Heathcock and finding my way in imaginatively and emotionally and intellectually into someone who is not me. And so, I mean, there are certain things you can teach. One, I just acknowledge that that's the job and that that's what they're trying to do, and put that up front. And then we do exercises and try to find ways into it. Some people have an ability, a gift, that immediate ability to be able to move into that place that is not them. And some people really, really struggle with them. That's something, as a teacher, there comes to a point I can't touch. You know, you kind of hope that's kind of an internal thing.
Exactly.
So all you can do is give the exercises out and kind of tell them how to get to the place, and then hope that they find their way in, or however they can. But I struggle with that. You know, it's not easy. You know, the first story in the book Volt is about a character who, in a tragic farming accident, kills his son, his own son, and that's kind of based on something that happened in my family. And gosh, that's a terrible place to take yourself emotionally, intellectually. It's a terrible place. And you know, obviously, I had never had something like that happen. And it took me a long, long time. It was very, very difficult to find my way into the truth of the moments that I needed to write. But I never gave up. Well, I just understood that that's what the job was. And so,
well, you did it beautifully in that case. There's no question about it that by the time you get to the end of that story, you do have some appreciation for what a father has to deal with when he has accidentally caused his son's death.
Yeah, gosh, that's, yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So Crafton, USA, the town you set these short stories in. Tell us what your motives were. Were you creating this to some extent nondescript town? That is, did you want to find a place that nobody could get too comfortable with as far as identifying, or is it the idea to get everybody to identify it with?
Well, a little of both, I suppose. In the book, I create this city of Crafton, and I never say what state it is, and I kind of create a region that has touches of a lot of different places in
right.
terms of flora and fauna and landscape. And that certainly was intentional. I remember years ago, I had a version of my story, Peacekeeper, come out, and I had identified the state at one time. I won't even say it here. But what I found was that a few of the readers got caught up on the state of where it was, thinking that I was making a commentary about that particular state. And they could not peel away that from it. The region was always a part of it. And I realized that in my own reading, I did that exact same thing. As soon as I understood the exact place something was set, I immediately applied every right and wrong idea I had about that place to what I was reading and how I understood it. And it was this extra layer of meaning that, you know, as an author, I could not control. And so I didn't like that because that wasn't what I was trying to do. I wasn't trying to really make a commentary about a region or a state. I was trying to make a commentary about the humanity of a place. And I knew then also because there's a certain amount of homogeneity with small towns in America, which is you go to a small town in any corner of our country, and there are going to be traits that are kind of common links between them all. So I've kind of gotten to have my cake and eat it, too, in that it's no place, but I travel all over the country. You know, I went to Martha's Vineyard, then I went down to New Mexico and down in Tennessee, and everybody is claiming that Crafton is, well, it's here, right? I'm like, yeah. And I just tell everybody, yeah, you're right.
One place it is definitely not, if I have any recollection of the Chicago area, is Hazelcrest. I mean, where you grew up.
Right,
maybe
right.
When you grew up there, it was a lot smaller than it is today, but it's still a suburb, isn't it? It doesn't look anything like
Crafton. No. Yeah, Hazelcrest is a relatively urban working class edge of the Chicago suburb. So in terms of landscape, I've said before, though, that Crafton could have been Hazelcrest just instead of fields and barns, I would replace them with, open lots and warehouses. It would be a more industrial landscape than a rural landscape. But then I think the people were about the same. I mean, the problems that the people had in my town of Hazelcrest, you know, it's a small community and close-knit community. So it was like a small town in the way people interacted. There were certain ways you're supposed to dress and talk and certain acceptable behaviors. And so I learned a lot about that. But I had to parlay my travels around the Midwest and that both of my parents are from very small towns and to use their insights in certain places, too. Mm-hmm. But it could have been Hazelcrest. Mm-hmm. But
well, we've run out of time, Alan, but I want to thank you for joining us today. And again, when I'm interviewing someone who's written short stories or fiction, I make every effort to do so without giving it all away. And I think we both have succeeded today in not giving it all away. So we want to remind our listeners again, the book is Volt by Alan Heathcock. And as you read these stories, recognize the fact that you may be seeing some of them on the screen one of these days. Alan Heathcock, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Alan Heathcock. Next week, Ira Shapiro, author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.